WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dan Fonte has been a limo driver, carnival barker, and telemarketer. He's been jailed, been in fights, and wrecked a number of cars, and he was drunk through a lot of it. That life is behind him, but it's the life he's given his alter ego, Bruno Dante, in a series of novels. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dan Fonte about his new novel, 86, and about being the son of writer John Fonte, whose 1939 novel, Ask the Dust, was republished in 1980 at the urging of writer Charles Bukowski. Also, we remember Unitarian minister Forrest Church. He died Thursday at the age of 61 from cancer. We'll listen back to an excerpt of our interview with him from last year when he knew he was facing death. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Door-to-door salesman, taxi driver, telemarketer, private eye, hotel night manager, chauffeur, those are just some of the jobs my guest Dan Fonte held before becoming a writer. But probably the more germane fact is that he didn't think of himself as a writer until after spending many years as a drunk, years he describes as train wrecks with off-the-wall, winner-take-all relationships. Fonte is the son of writer John Fonte, who's best known for his 1939 novel Ask the Dust, a novel set in L.A. during the Depression. The book was rescued from obscurity when the writer Charles Bukowski discovered it, helped get it republished in 1980, and wrote the introduction, in which he described John Fonte as his god. John died in 1983. Now Dan Fonte is in his 60s, sober, with several novels of his own, revolving around his alter ego, Bruno Dante, a character who has held many of the jobs his creator Dan Fonte has, but has not yet achieved sobriety. In Fonte's new novel, 86, Bruno has left his telemarketing job to work for a limo service while trying to deal with his demons. Dan Fonte, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a short reading from the second chapter of your novel, 86.
I have no idea why I am crazy and angry and edged out most of the time, and why alcohol and painkiller pills and Xanax-type stuff are the only things that help to keep me remotely calm. I have no idea why I experience my life as pointless and screwed up. And I know that most people don't pour a cup of bourbon into their milk and oatmeal in the morning. That's just how it is.
Well, thank you for reading that. You know, I'm thinking, you've been sober for years now, right?
I've been sober. I'll be sober 23 years in December.
Congratulations. So it must be pretty weird to be sober after a long time. And then immerse yourself in writing about somebody who's not, to always be going back to that place.
It's an interesting question, yeah.
How does it feel to always go back to the place of needing alcohol and needing pills and taking too much of both and getting really sick and getting into constant trouble?
Well, Kafka said a good novel should be like a blow to the head. And that's, you know, there's something I'm trying to say about the humanity of this character. And it's not yet been exhausted. So I go there and I can feel him because that's who I used to be.
If you think of alcohol and pills as self-medication, what conditions were you medicating for before you got sober?
Oh, my mind. I had the mental part of alcoholism as well as the physical addiction. And the mental part is this kind of obsessive, ruminative mind that just, I even named it. I named the voice in my head. I called him Jimmy. And he would just judge everything I did and judge your driving and what you were wearing and the brand of cigarettes you smoked. There was always this voice in my head.
Your character has that voice too, your character in your novel.
Well, yep.
So did drugs and alcohol silence the voice or?
Oh, sure. Yeah. They silence it while you're doing the drugs and the alcohol, and then there's the Mr. Hyde part of that character that's released in action. You don't hear the voice anymore, but you become the character. So, you know, jail and you know, fights and car wrecks and all this stuff that people like me go through when they have a Jones for alcohol and cocaine or whatever they're using is when I'm that stuff is inhabiting me, I'm not the same guy. Without that stuff, I'm not violent and I'm not angry. At least not now. In those days when I was sober and then the voice would really scream. The voice is the worst after a night of drinking.
Have you been to like a psychiatrist or psychologist about that voice? Seriously.
Well, let me say it to you this way, Terry. I did 14 years of therapy. I was Rolfed, rebirthed, and did Reiki in therapy, and that's just the R's.
What helped?
I did
most?
A lot of self-help because I thought self-help would fix it. Self-help, don't do it, you know.
What helped?
There's a spiritual program in the 12 Steps of Recovery that saved my butt. You know, I had to give up. You know, I just sober. I got beat down enough that I had to just surrender, just keep giving up the thoughts and keep asking for help. And you do that long enough, you know, you do that for 5 or 10 years, and your life begins to change. And that's, for some people, it doesn't take 5 or 10 years. I had what I call a vital spiritual experience when I was about, after a suicide attempt, when I was about 4.5 years sober. I was in a monastery with some guys on a 12-step retreat, and I started weeping, and I'm not a weeper. And I cried and had snot running down my face for about 2 hours, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And when I got up, everything was different. The colors were different. Everything was different, and I felt this amazing sense of love, just profound sense of well-being, and that's never left me. That was 18 years ago.
You have a poem that relates to this spiritual feeling that you're discussing. It's called Asking.
Yes.
And at the back of your novel, 86, there's the equivalent of bonus tracks. various short pieces that you've written and a few poems. And I'm going to ask you to read Asking.
Asking. For years, I thought that talking to the gods was an exercise done privately under unforgiving, distant stars. Ridiculous, unrequited prayer evoked by staring at old, cold books with mean, small print. Then I discovered that just ain't it at all. God can be found in the thank you voice of a guy at the counter in the supermarket, or the quietness of a stranger's parking lot smile, or the rattle of weeds across a dry summer Mojave, or watching my unfettered fingers jump, jump, jumping across the computer keys deep in the middle of typing 3 hours worth of unscrubbed truth. God, for me, turned out to be a conscious choice, a self-evoked experience, just like love.
I really like that idea at the end of God for you being a conscious choice, and that love for you being a conscious choice. It sounds like you had neither God nor love in your life for a long time.
Well, I had a lot of sex with all kinds of I've probably had sex with everything except a 1987 Ford pickup, you know. It's a choice, and it comes by consciously going there, by consciously asking and seeking that experience, and it begins to happen, you know.
In your novel, the character starts writing as a result of rehab. In rehab, he has to fill out a questionnaire, and the questionnaire has questions like, when you look back on your life, what memories are still uncomfortable and painful? What incidents make you feel dirty? And what about yourself do you experience as inadequate? Did you have to answer questions like that in rehab, and that inspire you to sit
endlessly
down and start writing? Yeah.
No, it inspired me to hate 12-step programs. I stumbled on a guy who had many years of sobriety and recovery, and he gave me this format of writing what's called an inventory in the 12 steps, a fourth step. And his form of inventory was to write the story of my life an hour a day for 12 consecutive days at exactly the same time every morning, and not to look back. And when I was done, to call him and read it to him. And so I called him and I said, Ken, I want to read this fourth step to you. And he said, well, how long are you sober, kid? And I said, well, I'm sober, a year this time, but I've been sober 3 out of the 5 years, you know. And he said, long pause on the other end of the phone. He said, you know, that's good in baseball. Call somebody else. And then he hung up. But what had happened to me, Terry, from that, and I didn't know it. It's interesting. I'm working on a memoir now about myself and my father, and I'm just at this part of the memoir. What happened from that, I had 31 typewritten pages, single-spaced, and it occurred to me a couple of years later that I couldn't write a novel, but I might be able to write a page a day from that exercise. And you know, I'm working on my 10th book right now. So I don't write books. I write pages.
My guest is Dan Fonte. His new novel is called 86th. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Fonte, and his new novel is called 86th. How would you describe your father's writing and the impact, if any, it had on you as a writer in terms of like the themes that he would write about, the stories that he would write about?
Well, it had an enormous impact stylistically, but my father was a victim of the quote, modern, unquote, literary canon. So I'm a postmodern writer. My father could not say the things that I say. And toward the end of his life, when he could, in the late 70s, when he was dictating his last book to my mother, he was blind, he could have been more graphic, and he wasn't. So he wrote primarily about his family and about his own experience with his family and about his dog. So our themes are different, I think, except for Ask the Dust. I mean, there's a similarity in Ask the Dust to my work. But I think he was trapped in a literary canon of 1931, you know.
Whereas you're writing very graphically about drugs and sex and not so much. I mean, I don't want to give the wrong idea. It's not pornographic or anything. But
no, it's true.
Okay. Right. But I mean, you're writing very much from someone who's really made a mess of his life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't think, you know, my dad became a successful Hollywood writer when he was quite young, 22, 23, and for the rest of his life was seduced back into screenwriting rather than do what his sensibility. He was born to be a novelist. He was born to be a storyteller, but, you know, he just couldn't refuse $500,000 a year, you know, or the equivalent of that.
That's what he was getting for being a script doctor?
Oh, God. His first paycheck, the guy walked in. Now, we're talking about 1932 or 33, and the man walked in and handed him a check for $250, which was the equivalent of maybe $3,000 or $4,000 for a week's work today. And he got up and went back. He opened his pay envelope and walked back to the guy and said, "You made a mistake. You put a zero on the end of the 25.
Well,
so he couldn't believe in so 1932, if you made $250 for a short story and you did it every 6 months, you could live on that. My father was making that every week in the movie business.
So you went from a pretty prosperous home to basically living in the gutter for a while.
Well, although, yes, I mean, I grew up in Malibu, but Malibu wasn't Malibu and when I grew up there. It was, you know, a beach town. Now it's got the, you know, those $70,000 a month recovery resorts and palazzos overlooking the Pacific Ocean. It was just a big windswept plateau when I lived there. But to call us prosperous, we were prosperous when he was working, you know, I guess.
Now, you held many jobs during the period when
yes.
you were drunk and using pills and other drugs. And one of those jobs was chauffeur. And
yes.
the character in your new novel, 86, is a chauffeur in L.A. And I'd like you to read a paragraph in which your character describes what that's like.
Okay. Working in the limo business in L.A. is a bizarre way to make a buck. Like licking up dog poop for God. The clientele for Dave Co. in Los Angeles was mostly made up of night freaks and zombies. Rich, cranked-out movie producers, spoiled rock star punks, gangster rappers with their black Glocks tucked into their belts of their pants, alky ex-actors with too many DUIs, and a gazillion wannabe high rollers. Human beings who exhibit the most unpleasant personality characteristics common to L.A., too much ego and way too much money.
So is that your experience of what it was like to be a limo driver?
Oh, yeah. No, I drove, I drove Rod Stewart and Mick Jagger and Ringo Starr. I drove Elton John. I drove John Lennon when he was alive.
Gee.
We had quite a clientele in those days.
So when you were driving for all these rock stars, were you sober then? Not that they were necessarily sober, but they probably want their driver to be sober.
Yeah, I knew early on when I was driving a cab in the 60s, early 70s, that I couldn't drink and drive. I knew it because my inclination is once I take a drink, I don't stop. I have to keep going. So I just wouldn't do it while I worked. Now, that held true until I got to California years later and owned the joint and with a partner, and then all bets were off. Then I started having, I started getting arrested more and had some problems.
Now, you've written about all the odd jobs that you've had over the years before you became a professional writer. Most of my adult life had been spent being one kind of pitch man or another. I've always found myself gravitating toward the jive and shuck, selling. This is strange to say because by nature, I don't like people and I'm a loner. So what kinds of things did you sell over the years?
Oh, God. My best gig I was a telemarketer. I sold when I lost the limo business and hit bottom and was homeless there for a while. I bumped into a guy who was a recovering heroin addict, and he had a phone room. And this was in the early 80s, and I began to sell computer supplies at the beginning of the blossoming of the computer supply industry. And I made, I think my best month, I was averaging about 25 grand a month.
Wow.
And that was in the, you know, the middle 80s, you know. And then I just, you know, had a house at the beach and a sports car and a aerobics teacher girlfriend. They all got relocated, Terry.
What do you mean?
When I took that first drink, things changed.
Oh, I got it.
And that was the end of my career. But I had about a 3-4 year run in that industry where I did very well. And then, but that bottoming out, what happened was, it's very interesting. I couldn't lie to people anymore. I got sober after, and I just couldn't lie to people anymore on the phone. Just couldn't do it. So, you know, I wound up homeless again, living in the back bedroom of my mother's house, with her giving me $50 a week for gas for her 7-cylinder Chrysler New Yorker that was 10 years old. And I just started walking to meetings and I didn't know what to do, so I started to write. That's when I started to write.
D'Infante will be back in the second half of the show. His new novel is called 86th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of Off the Tourist Trail, 1,000 Unexpected Travel Alternatives with a foreword by Bill Bryson. From Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. And from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. This is NPR.
In our interview last year when he was dying of cancer, Reverend Forrest Church said, "If you've made peace with your life, you can make peace with your death." Church died Thursday at the age of 61. Coming up, we listen back to an excerpt of that interview. And D'Infante talks about his relationship with his father, the writer John Fonte, who Charles Bukowski described as my God. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with D'Infante, who has written a series of novels about his alter ego, Bruno Dante, who lives the life D'Infante once lived, drunk and holding down jobs that used his skill as a pitchman, like telemarketing and carnival barker. In the new novel, 86th, Bruno has another job that D'Infante used to have, driving a limo. D'Infante is now writing a memoir about his late father, John Fonte, who was a screenwriter and novelist, best known for his 1939 book, Ask the Dust, set in L.A. during the Depression. It was republished in 1980 at the urging of writer Charles Bukowski, who described John Fonte as my God. I'm wondering if you have any passages from your father's work that you could quote for us that stand out in your mind and would give our listeners a sense of his writing?
Yeah, there's two. The first one that I brought with me because it...
Oh, I'm glad you did that. Thank you.
Yeah. People often ask me why I write, and so I had this... I have this quote from Kerouac, Jack Kerouac, on my wall, and I'll read it now. I want to work in revelations, not just spin silly tales for money. I want to fish as deep down as possible into my own subconscious, in the belief that once that far down, everyone will understand because they are the same as me that far down.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. That's why I write.
And do you have any passages from your father's books that stand out in your mind?
I have something I brought, Ask the Dust, with me. And this is this wonderful quote from the first two or three pages of John Fante's Ask the Dust. Los Angeles... Sorry. Makes me cry.
Oh. Yeah.
Los Angeles, give me some of you. Los Angeles, come to me the way I come to you, my feet over your streets. You pretty town. I loved you so much. You sad flower in the sand. You pretty town.
Obviously, it's very emotional for you to read that. From reading your own writing, the sense I get is that you and your father were pretty alienated from each other when you were young, and it was only later in life that you really got to...
That's true.
Got to know each other well?
No. I think got to accept one another, probably.
Uh-huh.
We started out... tolerating each other, disliking each other and tolerating each other. And then toward the end of his life, when I started to write, I once wrote a poem for a guy in upstate New York to dedicate his home. This guy was a very wealthy, I was a limo driver at the time in New York City, and very wealthy designer. And he took this 200-year-old farmhouse and completely redid it, gutted it, and completely redid it. And so I wrote a poem to dedicate the house. And the guy went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and he had it, a calligrapher, inscribe it on parchment, and then he had it pressed between two pieces of glass to last 500 years. And I went back to California and read the poem to my father. And he paid me, I was probably 38 years old, he paid me the first compliment he'd ever paid me in writing. He looked at me after he read it and he said, I couldn't have written that. So we went up from there.
Wow, first compliment, age 38?
Yeah, I guess.
Hmm.
He was not a, you know, my father was in a very patriarchal, from an Italian-American background. He's a tough guy, you know. And he had, you know, his father was an abusive drunk. And so, you know, I just, my father was an artist. He was just not connected to the planet. And the only thing that connected him were his two moods. One was angry and the other was angrier, you know.
So you kind of studied with a great mentor in terms of your anger.
Yeah, yeah. No, I a Picasso at a typewriter, you know. But a son of a bitch to live with, you know.
Yeah, yeah. He had diabetes, and toward the end of his life, he had a series of amputations. Tell me if I'm wrong. I think it was his toes, then his feet, then his legs.
Awful, yeah. No,
and he was blind at the end? What was left of him spiritually, like at his emotional core? What was left of him as his body?
Well,
kept
you know,
getting
after
diminished?
I mean, he was traumatized by these thin-lipped surgeons in Santa Monica wearing bow ties and with two golf club bags in the trunk of their car, and they just kept hacking his body parts off, you know. And rather than take the whole leg, they'd take a couple of toes. 3 months later, they'd take a few more. Then they'd take the foot at the ankle. Then when that didn't, when that became gangrenous, then they'd go above the knee. So he had that double the ones I've just talked about for each leg, and so he had that many surgeries, and it was it was hideous. It was just a kind of a living dismemberment, and then. As a bonus, after those surgeries, he got glaucoma and went blind in about 10 days. So he had a rough time. And but during that time, after he went blind, an amazing thing happened. He was in the hospital and incoherent. We thought he was going to die. And he got a phone call from a screenwriter, a director screenwriter, and named Robert Towne. Robert Towne had a film option on Ask the Dust at that time for 20 years.
Let me just say Robert Towne is probably best known for writing the screenplay for Chinatown.
Correct. So the phone rang in my father's hospital room, and I picked it up, and it was Robert Towne, and I said, "Pop, it's Robert Towne." And he immediately became coherent. And for the rest of his life, he was kind. But if it was business, if it was about his work, he was on the money. And then blind, a double amputee, he dictated his last book to my mother, word for word, while I sat there occasionally and listened. Word for word. Never paused. And he would do a page or two a day. And in 2 months, he'd dictated, and it was brilliant stuff.
Where were you in your life when your father died?
I was sober for I was sober and working in telemarketing, and I remember a year and a half before I went to a Christmas dinner at my parents' house, and my father had just gone blind, and I brought the wine, and I finished off about a gallon of a good rosé, good supermarket rosé, and I told him he deserved to be blind, and he was a rotten old son of a bitch, and that night I got one of my DUIs, and I tried to kill myself in the Malibu jail that night. And but when my father actually died, I was sitting next to him. I'd been sober a year or so, and I was holding his hand. And we had made our peace, you know. We loved each other.
So what do you have of his now that you cherish most, and just in terms of like original manuscripts or, you know, other personal possessions that mean the most to you of his?
Do you know, it's extraordinary, but when I wrote my first novel, I was quite insane and suicidal when I wrote my novel Chump Change, and it reads like it. I was living in my mother's back bedroom with her, as I mentioned, giving me gas money, and I went out to the garage one day, and I found his typewriter, an old Smith Corona portable that was all dusty. And then I found half a ream of yellow legal typing paper. It was the same paper he wrote his last novel on when he could see and type. I wrote my first novel on his typewriter using his typewriter paper.
In the acknowledgments of your new novel, 86th, you thank Betty Levette, the great soul singer, you thank her for changing your life with a single blues song.
Absolutely.
I'd love to know what that song is. And how it changed your life.
She sang at the inauguration of Barack Obama. It's been a long time coming, but a change is going to come. And, boy, that was it for me. Little Richard did the same thing when I was 12 years old. When I heard Little Richard sing Lucille, I said, that man's not of this planet. There's something completely mad and transcendent about that guy. And he's still the same. He's just the spirit. There's something that's beyond the voice. There's something that connects viscerally to those two people.
I guess you weren't thinking of political change when you heard that.
I was thinking of Betty LeVette and how she could, man, she could lay it down.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. Thank you for having me on and talking about my stuff and my book and my father's work. It's a great pleasure for me.
Can I just ask you one more thing?
Sure.
It feels like your emotions are very, like some of your emotions are very much on the surface, very close to the surface is what I mean.
Uh-huh.
And that you get in touch with your emotions. And I'm wondering during the period when you were kind of deadening things with alcohol and drugs, were you as given to being emotional then, or did you, were
never.
You, were you killing that off?
I'm sure I didn't cry for 25 years. Uh-huh. Sure of it. Not, and even death and bad stuff, divorces, jail. I didn't shed a tear for 25 years. No, when there's nothing between me and who I am, when all that peanut butter is gone, you know, it's pretty easy to demonstrate emotion.
Right. Okay, well, thank you again. Good luck with the book, and thanks a lot.
Terry, thank you.
Dan Fonte is the author of the new novel, 86th.
In a little bitty home tent, long just like that river. I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long, a long time coming, but I always believed that a change was gonna come.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Unitarian minister Forrest Church, recorded last year when he knew he was dying of cancer. Church died last Thursday at the age of 61. This is Fresh Air. Death was a central part of the definition of religion for Unitarian minister Forrest Church. He said, "Knowing that we must die, we question what life means." Questions about life's purpose acquired a new sense of urgency when Church was diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus 3 years ago. That was just a dress rehearsal for death. The cancer was treated and he returned to his work. But early last year, the cancer returned with a vengeance. Church died last Thursday at the age of 61. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded with him about facing death 1 year ago. He had spent 3 decades as senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in New York City. One of his many books was about his late father, Frank Church, who was a Democratic senator from Idaho. When we spoke, he had just published a book called Love and Death, My Journey Through the Valley of the Shadow. I want to start by reading something that you say in your book that really got to me. And this is right after your thoughts about your life and you thought imminent death right after your first diagnosis. You write, "I embraced the diagnosis and started girding myself to die. No disbelief, no anger, no bargaining. In fact, if anything, I walked around in a pink cloud for a day or two, feeling my death, getting used to it. Was my theology working or was I simply in denial or shock? Looking back, was your theology working, or were you in denial or shock?
It was working. Every minister spends a lifetime preparing for this exam. The most important work we do is done with families in bereavement. But we really don't know, having given all of this advice and held all of these hands and walked all of these journeys through the valley, how we ourselves are going to respond. And it was a great relief to me that I was able to embrace my death. I sense that if you've made peace with your life, you can make peace with your death. But if you haven't, it's much more difficult. The difference, all of us have ongoing business when we're given a terminal diagnosis. But the question is, do we have unfinished business? And I discovered I really didn't have any unfinished business, and that allowed me to be present for whatever was going to come. I didn't have to find myself bathing in regret or filled with anxious anticipation. I just sort of entered the zone, and I've been there for some time.
Okay, so on the one hand, you feel like you reached acceptance of your death right after your diagnosis, and you kind of entered the zone. But at the same time, you write in your book, your wife, who was on the way to a trip to India when you were diagnosed, when she came home, she kind of knocked you out of that and said,
"That's right.
Don't be so accepting of this."
She pointed out to me in no uncertain terms that this death was not mine alone. It was fine for me to splash around in the waters of acceptance and to say that I had no unfinished business, but there were a lot of other people around me who had unfinished business. I mean, my children, my four children, my wife. And that shifted it sort of knocked the air out of my presumption and allowed me to focus on their needs and concerns as opposed to taking too great a pleasure in my own spiritual satisfaction.
You know, you write in your book, again, about how you don't believe in an interventionist God. And you say, once you start praying to God to cure your cancer, or asking God why he didn't answer your prayers, the questions never stop. And then you refer to, like, a bishop who said his faith was shaken by the tsunami.
Yes.
And then you say you don't like it when people say about a tragedy or about, an illness or death. Well, God has his reasons. It's just part of God's plan.
This is God's plan.
What do you object to about that? Why isn't that?
Well, I can see how it can give comfort. But God doesn't throw a 3-year-old child out of a third-story window or allow a drunken driver to kill a family crossing the street. This is not part of God's plan. These are the accidents of life and death. And if God, for instance, is responsible for a tsunami that obliterates the lives of 100,000 people and leaves their families in tatters, then God's a bastard. I cannot believe in such a God. For me, God is the life force, that which is greater than all and yet present in each. But God is not micromanaging this world. That is a presumption that we are naturally drawn to because of our sense of centrality and self-importance. But there are 1,500 stars for every living human being. And the God that I believe in is an absolute magnificent mystery.
Was there a period where you thought that if you weren't right with the diagnosis, if you couldn't handle the pain or the recovery or the fear of death, the approach of death, that you would have been proven to be a fraud? Because here you've been making death a central part
of your
vision of religion. Yeah.
There's no question about that. And that's why I was so relieved. And I tested my own acceptance because I was afraid that I could fool myself. I would so need to do well. I need to ace the death exam, having made death such a pivot of my own theology. Otherwise, there would have been a kind of, most deeply felt, I think, by me, a sense that I have been a snake oil salesman of some sort.
We're listening back to an interview with Unitarian minister Forrest Church, recorded 1 year ago. He died of cancer last Thursday at the age of 61. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to an interview recorded 1 year ago with Unitarian minister Forrest Church when he knew he was dying of cancer. Church died last Thursday at the age of 61.
When you were young, you romanticized death. You write that a lot of your heroes
yes.
were writers and poets who died
who
young.
Died young, yes.
You even told your friend when you were 19 that you were confident you weren't going to live past the age of 25.
Past 25, yes.
And
that basically set me free from many, many responsibilities that I otherwise might have had to take on my shoulder. Well, if I was going to die young, I simply, my obligation was simply to live absolutely fully, pull out all the stops and not worry too much about minor things like careers and families and all of that. It was a very romantic notion that in some ways was dispensed with, was ended by the death of my closest friend, whom I'd actually boasted that I was going to die by 25, giving a kind of glamour or romance to my life that it might otherwise not have had. He died at 19 of pneumonia when he was skiing. And all of a sudden, death became real. It was no longer the exquisite angel of romantic poetry that was going to embrace you on the ship's deck. It was a hard, real reality that demanded a response.
So, what was the difference between you before and after your friend's death? You said before. It sounds like it was very liberating to think about dying young because it was...
It was completely liberating.
Yeah.
As I said, it removed responsibilities.
Yeah. Everybody's got their way, or a lot of people have their way when they're young, of finding a way to try to be as free as you can in that moment.
It was also an act of self-importance. I mean, I couldn't imagine outstripping my famous father. And, the only thing that I could do that would be dramatic would be to die young. That would take no particular effort on my part.
Oh, interesting. And then you wouldn't even have to worry about measuring
have to
up
compete,
to him or anything.
You'd have to live
yeah.
up to him and compete with him. I'm sure that was part of it.
Now, something else you write about in the book is that for a while you drank.
Yes.
And
I self-medicated.
Yeah, and I think anyone would wonder about a minister who drank. If you were in a good enough place spiritually to lead a congregation, then why would you need to self-medicate?
Well, it obviously was, there was something, there was a demonic dimension to it. It was in some ways a God substitute. It was some ways driven by fear. It was not anything that anyone noticed. I other than myself and my wife, it was something that bothered me a great deal and had taken possession of a part of my soul. There's no question but that I was beguiled by and distracted by the lure of the bottle. And it wasn't until, I had so many attempts to stop, often successful enough to let me believe that I wasn't dependent. But it wasn't until 2000 when my wife basically told me that I could be her roommate or her partner, but she was not going to have someone who was not fully present at home. That I stopped drinking, and I haven't had a drink since. It's been a marvelous second life. I didn't change any of my views, by the way, Terry. It's what I thought before I now felt. My theology was now felt at a very deep level. My fear was gone. It's all been gravy since then.
I want to get back to mortality. How much time would you say in your typical day you spend thinking about death?
At this point, Terry, I probably spend almost no time thinking about death. For the first time in my life, I'm living completely in the present. I have, as I said about a terminal illness where you have time, in a sense, it allows you to sort of co-script your final act. To be able to write Love and Death was to be able to put a coda on my life. I've been able to conclude my active life as opposed to it just ending. I'm not yet at the point of being on my deathbed, so I'm in sort of an in-between place. Each day is, I read, I chat with my friends who are ever more attentive. We take our friends for granted as well, and when there's a short amount of time, they come out of the woodwork, old friends, and we spend lots of time together. And I'm just in the present. When the time comes, when I am closer to my deathbed or on it, I'm certain that I'll begin probably even fearing to some degree the passage. But there's no fear in my mind now, and there's no preoccupation by death. I don't push my nose up against that dark pane in my window. I stand back and let the light shine on me.
Forrest Church recorded 1 year ago. He died of cancer Thursday at the age of 61. He spent nearly three decades as the senior minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directed the show with John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Subaru, with the safety and performance of all-wheel drive on every vehicle. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. And from the Pew Health Group, part of the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to improve the health and safety of all Americans at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
Nick Hornby's new novel, Juliet Naked, like his novel High Fidelity, is full of music-obsessed characters. But this time, it's not just the fan's vantage point he's writing from, but also the fan's girlfriend and the musician he's obsessed with. On the next Fresh Air, Hornby talks about his new novel and his screenplay for the new film in education, set in post-war pre-rock England. Join us for the next Fresh Air.